Would you be happy to buy an apartment that didn't have its own laundry and didn't have an ensuite or even a car park? What if it was cheaper though and meant you could live more sustainably? That's what collaborative housing is all about. We had a look at how this can work a couple of weeks back, and now Michael McKenzie has part two of Reimagining the Block.
So we've got a communal laundry, 6 washing machines, which means you can come home from your holidays and do everything at once, providing there's enough room on the rather large, extensive clothesline.
This is Bronwyn, who a few years ago bought into the prototype building for this collaborative approach to living.
And round the side of the laundry, what's that round there?
That's a veranda that holds 2 beehives.
We're on the 5th floor of a building called the Commons.
And who gets to harvest the honey?
Well, we have a bee group, and I've actually suited up at one stage just to get a little bit more intimate with the bees. But yeah, there's a couple of people who do the bottling up, and once a year we get a free jar of honey and occasionally more.
It's clearly a shared space.
And then the bees, of course, need flowers for bringing pollen back to the hive.
Yes, so the other end that I haven't shown you yet is a productive garden, lots of plots. There's a lot of wind and a lot of sun, so we have to take care of these plants, but still lots of fun.
Let's head on down now to Bronwyn's apartment, where one of the people behind this design lays out why it happened in the first place.
85% of Australian apartments were sold as investment stock, which means only 15% of residents living in those buildings were actually owner-occupiers. And if you live in a one-bedroom apartment in the city of Melbourne, in all likelihood, you will live there for only 11 months.
This is architect Jeremy McLeod. He and like-minded urban designers wanted to try another way of approaching apartment living.
If you think about a developer, you think about someone that is developing speculative property as an intent to make profit. For us, we established housing to affect market change, to revolutionise the way we live together, the way that it happens so well in Europe. We deliver all of our projects at cost with no profit motive. So we source the capital for our projects from impact investors, and then we return a capped return to those impact investors. The money that's left over at the end of the project, once we've paid back all the impact investors, paid back all the bank debt, and we have a contingency in case something goes wrong during construction, or we find out, you know, there's some rock or something in the ground during construction, so we have a contingency. At the end of the project, the unspent contingency isn't kept as profit. We return it back to the residents. So everyone signs a contract of sale at a particular apartment price, and then after they move in, we give them a cheque back for the money that we haven't spent.
This all sounds very utopian, doesn't it? But there are some caveats around this setup.
We actively discourage investors. So in Nightingale 1, we interviewed everyone personally. In the Commons, the real estate agent was told that we were looking specifically for owner-occupiers. So of the Commons, 22 of 24 apartments were sold to owner-occupiers. In Nightingale 1, it's 100% owner-occupiers. That the restrictive caveat is designed specifically to disincentivise investors because it caps their ability to profit maximise.
And in case you're wondering, you can buy as an owner-occupier and then later turn that into a rental property, which means, in effect, it becomes an investment. However, you are very strongly encouraged not to price gouge through the rent.
It's very, very difficult to build community with short-term leases that can be increased at any time.
And if you ever decide to sell the property, you can only sell it for what you paid for, plus whatever percentage rate of increase has happened across that entire suburb.
What did that mean for you as someone coming in the second generation of resident in this space?
Well, I guess it meant that I paid more than had I bought a year before, but, you know, it's like a great big household.
And yet you have your own separate space when you want to be private.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And doesn't mean that this more resident-focused outcome results in fewer defects. Well, not necessarily.
Something that worries so many people is when things go wrong. And I know it's hard in front of the founding architect and then the second-generation architect for the next building. But have things gone wrong structurally or in any other way since you bought in 5 years ago?
Yeah, we've had a few defects. They've mainly been leaks. But they've been rectified.
Who pays for the rectification?
There was money left over from the original development.
Where were the leaks? Were they in the kitchen or where were they?
Varying places. One of mine came down a downpipe. So, yeah, it wasn't serious.
Any cracks?
Nah.
I might come to James Legg now because James is the architect responsible for the next Nightingale project, which is cunningly called Nightingale 2. But James, people may be feeling very wary of any discussion about building defects.
Look, that's correct. I think the debate that's going on in the media at the moment is slightly shrill. I think that obviously there have been some very serious defects that have occurred in buildings. But people do need to understand that building an apartment building, it's a bespoke single thing. Many people work on it. It's very difficult to test everything before everyone moves in. It's very difficult to replicate the occupancy of 40 people and the hot water service and the heating services and these sorts of things, and even the lift. And so you're always racing to get the building finished towards the end. The builder's trying to get the building finished. We're encouraging the builder to get the building finished. And invariably there are defects. Now, defects range from a chip of paint through to some of the catastrophes that are happening elsewhere in the country. So people need to be aware that a defect is many things. You expect to get some defects. However, you need to be able to resolve the defects over the first few months. So people move into their building, there will be defects. There needs to be a good process of rectifying those defects and ensuring that there aren't major defects. And that's common practice, really, that the builder will be on the hook, if you like, for at least a year, just completing defects. And we hold on to some of their finance until that year is over. And at the end of that period, they're still responsible for completing or rectifying defects for another 7 years or so.
One of the great bugbears, it seems, in the current system, as we have it at the moment, of building new apartment dwellings, is that you have private building certifiers who are paid by the builder and therefore have an inherent conflict of interest when it comes to declaring any parts of the building in breach. How did you, Jeremy, I might ask you this, as founder of this whole project, how do you traverse that area?
In my experience as an architect, you know, we deal with private building certifiers all the time, and I find them to be incredibly professional and incredibly diligent and dealing with the building at the kind of scale that we're operating at, whether it's 20 or 24 or 30 apartments. To meet the National Construction Code, to meet the Building Code of Australia requirements, we have a raft of, you know, incredibly skilled engineers and consultants. My issue is not with private certifiers. I just feel like there needs to be a little bit more of an allowance in the feasibility for some more time on site by the architects, so who coordinate all the documentation, by the structural engineers, in fact, by all the engineers. So, you know, particularly like the structural engineers, the hydraulics engineers who do the water, and so that they can be there at kind of at key stages, not just for kind of monthly inspections.
I'm Michael McKenzie, this is Life Matters, and with me are architects Jeremy McLeod and James Legg, along with apartment resident Bronwyn Plair, who lives in the prototype for this different approach to housing.
So, yes, I'd like to show you the garage, which is really just a whole glamorous bike park.
Okay, is that downstairs?
Yeah.
Okay, let's
go.
Can
we do that?
Good. Yeah.
This is Wormwee. So we have worm farms, seven of them downstairs in the refuse room.
And who is responsible for distributing the wormwee and castings?
Well, the distribution is up to everybody, but the collection and the maintenance of the worm farm is up to myself and another lovely lady that, you know, do some regular maintenance. But they really look after themselves. And what it means is that we were issued with, I think it was, 8 rubbish bins and 8 recycling bins when we first started. And that's been reduced now to 3 rubbish bins and 5 recycled bins.
What, for 24 apartments?
Yeah, yeah. They're the big ones, but we're really proud and we can do more. We can do better than that.
In terms of how we expand this and roll it out, I mean, we're quite happy for other people to do exactly the same thing that we're doing at Nightingale Housing. In fact, we welcome the idea that other developers would look to a similar scheme where essentially It's just the cost of equity. That's what your profit is. There's no more than that. You're not trying to wring every last dollar out. You're trying to deliver people homes rather than investments.
The incredible thing for us is that we've seen another project just around the corner from this, which is 7.5 stars, carbon neutral in operations, community focused, rooftop gardens, bees on the roof, looks and smells like a nightingale. It's just got some car parking and air conditioning.
That's really encouraging. But yeah. I have to say, they're all inner urban Melbourne. And I'm just wondering, when I said scalable, do you reckon the values you're trying to embed in what you do here is going to find favour across the wider housing market?
Yeah, so look, we've just embarked on our first regional project. So Ballarat, Bendigo, Geelong, they're all undergoing the same kind of urban sprawl issues that Melbourne's undergoing, building over our agricultural land. So we've just embarked on our first project, which is incredible, right in the centre of Ballarat. It's got all the same principles as this. It's impossible for us to deliver affordable housing in Sydney because of the cost of land. So we've partnered with church groups in Sydney. The church is putting in the land. They're building under all the Nightingale principles, carbon neutral, community focused, and they're going to rent that out at cost. So they'll rent that out at kind of, 30% under market.
And so we really need to start looking at other models and how apartments can be suitable places to bring up families, provided they're delivered in the right way.
But what the laundry doubles up as is a really nice little bar. That little window opens and that's where we can keep our champers on ice. We've got a barbecue, we've got an outdoor table.
Yeah.
And a almost 360 degree view of Melbourne, fantastic on New Year's Eve.
Does everyone gather in one place at one time ever?
Yes. We have about 8 occasions a year, and sort of on a fairly regular basis, where we'll just get together, whether it's for a breakfast. We had a progressive dinner at Course on each floor a month or so ago. That's what I like about living here.
Everyone looks out for everyone else.
That's right, yeah. It's a lovely community.